there in quarantine land, welcome to Art and Labor. We're a podcast, and we're all at home.
Yes,
but even though we're all at home, we're joined by a guest today.
Yeah, we're from one of the beloved memesters from Instagram, Jerry Gagosian, is here.
Hello. I'm just imagining.
So good to have you.
And I'm imagining like an applause.
Right now. Yeah. Oh my God! Yes! Jerry speaks!
Hello, everybody.
Hey.
Hey.
It's lovely to have you here.
Yeah, I'm really excited for you to join us. I mean, it's just been like, it's really amazing to have you as a presence in my online life without knowing like who was behind the account or anything.
Yeah.
And yeah, to watch everything, like the conversation around your work grow kind of exponentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been really exciting.
Thank you. It's been exciting for me, and it's been equal parts. I'm sure like over the next hour I'll like tell you guys a little bit about myself, but like trust me when I say that never in 10,000 years did I ever think like anybody would follow my account like at all.
Yeah.
When I started it, I remember having like 111 followers and genuinely thinking to myself like, who the fuck's following this account? Like, who are these 111 losers?
Oh man, the real heads.
Yeah. Sometimes people DM me, they're like, oh my God, I've been following you since you had like 1500 followers. I'm like, wow, hardcore fan.
Yeah. Whoa. That's beautiful though. You know, the message resonates.
Well, it resonates, but you know, one thing that like, gets lost now when you have like more followers is there's some like pretty specific narratives that I've like carved out for some of these like fake characters like Zoe and Chloe. And there used to be a gallery manager who like everybody knew was the gallery manager. Her name was Nina, and like my friend and I were talking the other day, he's like, where's Nina? And I'm like, I don't know, Nina's like in rehab, like she's like nobody remembers anymore. Like I think even now, like already the internet forgets so fast. Like I try to make like Zoe and Chloe jokes and like nobody likes it because nobody understands who Zoe
oh my
and
god
are.
What if there was like an Anna Mendieta protest, but instead all of the signs said, where's Nina?
Oh my god.
No. Sorry, that's really dark.
Too real.
Where is Nina? I don't know. We have to, maybe Nina will come out during quarantine. But like nobody would get the Nina jokes anymore except for like the old school followers of Jerry.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta throw them a little bone there.
Yeah.
So Jerry, you were gonna tell us a little bit about how the Jerry Gagosian count started.
Yeah. I have to like tell you who I am a little bit. Like I studied art for 7 years academically as an artist. And I went to school, I studied in Norway at the school, this anarchist art school called Strykjerna. And then I studied at San Francisco Art Institute. And then I studied for a year at Valand Kunstakademi in Sweden. And then I studied for like 6 months with my former collaborator when he was enrolled at Stadelschule. So I kind of had this like long Odyssean education. And when I graduated, I was like living in Europe, making films with my ex, and then we split up and I had to move home to my parents' house, and I was like 26, 27, and I didn't know what I was going to do. So I got a job working at an art gallery because I was like super unemployable. You know, like when you have an art degree, you can't like do anything.
Yep.
And I was, yeah, like I mean, I remember applying for like fucking receptionist jobs and then being like, well, you have an art degree. Like,
yeah, I feel that. You know, I was just trying to go through the job search again and again, but the last round, I only got a job driving a truck, but for a framing company. Like, I can't even drive a truck for something regular.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I literally was a receptionist for Artform, and before that, I literally just packed their issues for them. That was like my job for like 3 years.
Yeah, and like
I mean, yeah, well, the vintage store, the vintage store is a job.
You're still talking about it. Oh no, that's true. I feel like the vintage store is like hanging out, though.
I mean, it's a little of both.
I always associate
well,
it with having a party.
That's because I try to make it as little of a job as possible by making people come visit me at work so I don't have to do the actual work tasks.
Yeah, I forget about that. I'm like, oh yeah, you are technically on the job.
Well, like I said before we started recording, I haven't worked in the art world in a couple of years now, but that was my last art world job.
Yeah. No, but you're good. You're like good at staying out of jobs in general.
Oh yeah, don't fuck that. I don't want to do. I mean, I do freelance printing for artists, which is like a tangential, but that's about it, you know.
Yeah. So there you were, caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah,
you couldn't even answer people's emails.
Honestly, no. I couldn't cut it because it was like, you know, there was the huge sexual harassment scandal. But, like, even beyond that, like, I hated it before the scandal and couldn't stand doing it.
but we're here. We're here frozen in the midst of the Jerry Gagosian saga in the dark night of the soul period.
Yes. It was super dark. Yeah. And I, like, literally the only job I could get was, like, driving a golf cart at the country club near my parents' house, like, serving alcohol to like bankers that were like pretending to work, you know. And I was just like so envious too, because I was like, these motherfuckers, like this is them working, like getting tanked and like smoking cigars and like making crazy ridiculous golf bets. And here I am with like 7 years of education and like thinking about Lacan, like driving a fucking beverage cart, you know, like it was just ridiculous, like going home and watching like German cinema at night and then having to serve like chicken fingers and like ketchup to grown men during the day. It was just so unrefined.
Oh my god, wait, did you so they were day drinkers?
Oh yeah, golf culture.
Yeah. Oh great.
Yeah, like getting hit on by like 65-year-olds that have scotch breath. Like it was like very unromantic.
Big red walrus faces.
Yep. But so that was me. And then so I applied for an internship an hour and 20 minutes away at my parents live in Florida, and in Miami, in this area called Wynwood, there was like an art gallery that had listed online that they were looking for someone.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Wait, Wynwood is where a lot of the satellite fairs happen, right?
Yeah, and it used to be it used to be different. It was like this really cool place, like back, like I kind of caught the tail end of it. So whatever year that was, like 2013 or 2014, like it was still this kind of undeveloped, cool, like there was like 5 galleries over there. And then there was like 1 coffee shop, and it was like kind of Brooklyn vibes, if I'm being totally honest. It was cool. And I started working for, this art gallery just as they're like, I don't want to say their names, 'cause I don't want to like, they're really, really nice people. Okay. Like I have nothing against them, but they weren't like the most serious like art business. Okay. They were like, I don't want to call it a vanity project. It was definitely like more of a passion project in my eyes than it was like a hardcore cutthroat Chelsea gallery. But like,
well, there's a lot of passion and vanity mixed up in this whole scene.
Yes. Okay. So we'll put it like that. Because I don't want to like sound dismissive towards what they do, because like, this is my thing. Like, I don't like when people criticize people just because they have money that are in the art world, because you know what? Like, they could be doing a lot of other shit. They could be making like $1,000 golf bets every day instead of like funding a painter or, you know,
yeah,
spending their time doing that. So like, it's also,
they could be making bullets.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of them do both.
Yeah.
So so I started working for them, and then they were gonna go out of town for like the summer, because like the art world's dead in the summer, and they asked me if I wanted to like get like a slight pay increase and just work more with the director. And they like let me live in their amazing house and like drive their Tesla and like, you know, like all of a sudden it was like a total performance. I was just playing like gallerist dress up for myself, because I was like, this is so fun. I get to like live in this gorgeous house with their like wine collection. They were like, have whatever you want, you know, like swim naked in their pool and eat mushrooms and like,
oh my God,
show up to the gallery at like 11 a.m. and like be there until like, you know, 4, and then like friends would start coming and we would drink and like, you know what I mean? It was like a very fun,
full on life.
Yeah. I was like living it the fuck up. It was really fun. But then I decided I wanted to go to grad school, and I got accepted. Like, I needed more education. I decided to go to grad school in New York.
Well, everybody knows that grad school is like that thing you do when it's like, oh shit, what do I do now?
Yeah. I mean, it's a joke, and I'm super against art school, but I got to New York, and within like, I don't know, 5 weeks, I dropped out, because I was like, I don't fucking need this. So then I decided to like rough it the hard way. So I got an internship at this artist-run space called Regina Rex, which had moved from Brooklyn to the Lower East Side. And I was living in Morningside Heights, and my apartment at the time was like really big by New York standards. It was like a little under 2,000 square feet, and I paid $500 a month for it, but it was like super uninhabitable. It hadn't been renovated since 1973. So I decided, like, instead of trying to make it livable, I just slept on an air mattress and I turned it into like a project space. So I like had my project space. I was interning. I was also like a personal assistant, and I was a waitress, and I was a registrar at an art gallery. I mean, I remember one time I went 27 days without working one day, and like sometimes working like two or three jobs a day within those time periods. I mean, it was like the hardest work of my life. I always, like, when people are like, should I move to New York and like become an artist, I'm always like, I don't know, are you rich, or do you love like being people's like personal assistants? Because that's like what you're gonna end up doing, you know?
Yeah, you could end up being a pretty high class assistant though.
Oh.
And then you kind of end up acting as a proxy for that person, and you'll only know who's the real boss, you know, in person.
Who is who?
Oh no, I was, and again, these are some people that I care about, so I don't want to be like overly dismissive towards them, but I was definitely a rich lady's babysitter. That was one of my jobs. Like, literally my job was like to shop with her during the day and then start getting drunk with her around 4 o'clock, like every single day. Like, that was my
job. No, there's like a lot of good people actually performing like really intense emotional labor on like a daily basis, and that I mean, no, it is true though. No,
it's like real. Like, I've definitely had a gig like that, like for a summer. Like, I did a rich lady's whole taxes for her, and it was like, this is crazy. Like, like an intern fresh out of school doing this, like, you know, multimillionaire's taxes for her.
Like,
oh no, but mine wasn't even that. She was like an interior designer with, she was an interior designer, but maybe she hadn't really like worked in a long time, and her life was more about like fancy dinners and
no, yeah, I get that,
going to the Hamptons and, you know, that kind of thing.
No, yeah, you go to all the functions, like that's part of it.
Oh, man, one time I had this job making pies for someone who would get written up by the New York Times all the time. And it was just like, all right, today you have to make 75 pies. And I was like, I don't know how to make pies. And they're like, YouTube it.
What?
Yeah, it is wild. I mean, I did a good, I'm a pretty all right cook because it's just about directions really and patience. Yeah. But like, yeah, that was one of the most magical. We made it. We made a whole rooftop garden party, and like we had bands, and everything came together like right at the nick of time. But yeah,
part of the
those jobs. There's no real way to describe them.
But you, but
you can't put that on a resume.
That
yeah. Experience. Well, I mean, I just told her, listen, I'm gonna decide what my resume says this job was, and you just need to go along with it. And she was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Like she didn't care.
No,
she like did not.
That's
care,
how you do it. No, it's true. That's how you got to do it. That's how you have to handle it. Because like you know, Lord knows, like when we talked about this on the podcast all the time. Like you know, our weird amalgamated resumes trying to get work. Like you have to finagle it to make it make sense to the type of job you're applying to.
Yeah, and also like, I mean, a lot of people don't check anyway. Like things they never tell you in art school. Like,
oh, yeah.
no one's gonna ever ask to see a copy of your diploma. Like, it's just not gonna happen. So, you know, you have to be like scrappy. But I mean, I started, all this is going on, right? Like, I'm working for said wealthy woman. I was also like this CEO's like personal assistant, which was like really a brutal job. I was waitress, had like all these jobs, like just trying to make it because. On top of living in one of the most expensive cities in the world, I also am in $150,000 worth of student debt, you know? So it's not like I was like bawling out. I wasn't like bawling out because of my three jobs, you know? I was like just making it because then you got to like pay to like play, right? Like you got to be able to go out and have those $18 glasses of rosé with everyone, and you got to be able to afford to fly to fucking Art Basel in Switzerland and do this, like, you know, and go to somebody's wedding in South Africa and, you know, do all these like different, you know, in order to sort of stay in that.
Yeah, it's not easy to save.
Yeah, in order to stay in that realm, like it's fucking expensive. So I was doing all these things, still identifying like as an artist. And then one of my like best friends is this painter named Henry Gunderson. And he started this project.
Oh, dude. His paintings are so dope.
I know. He's amazing. But he's an amazing artist. Like he's like an amazing artist, period. Like he doesn't just paint. One of the projects that he did for years and years is this project called Water McBeer. Do you know about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he asked me if I wanted to be Water McBeer's executive director of sales. So I would like go to art fairs on behalf of Water McBeer and like sell dollhouse like art booths to people. And like never acknowledge the fact that there was like scale involved. Like people would be like, oh my god, I didn't realize it was so small. And I'd be like I would never acknowledge it. I'd be like, you know, at Water McBeer we're not concerned with time or space. Like I would just give these like really annoying answers.
Yeah, and meanwhile you're selling like a tiny like minimalist sculpture that looks like it's made out of like a pipe cleaner or something.
Yeah, or like a tiny Jamie and Giuliano Villani painting or yeah.
I have a technical question actually.
Yeah.
Is it a tiny painting?
Yes. They're all actual artworks. They're not like replications. Yeah, they're all actually the things that they say that they are. If you guys don't know, to the listeners out there, if you don't know what Water McBeer is, you should just Google it.
I will link it in the show notes for sure.
It's like one of my favorite art projects, like period. And I'm very glad that I was part of it. So I did that for Henry around the same time that I started getting like subcontracted to go and work for people at art fairs because I can art speak if I want to art speak, you know? I think it's like the most useless language on the planet. And I think it's like so alienating and like intentionally so, but like you know, I can art speak. I can fucking, you know, dance circles around people, but it's like ridiculous. Nobody talks that way. I just went to a Mega Galleries like walkthrough on Zoom yesterday, and I was just like writing down line by line what they were saying and like LOLing. I'm like, because my mic was on mute, because I'm like, they are saying nothing, like nothing, you know. Yeah. And meanwhile,
but neither do politics, you know, politicians. They're kind of the same in the way that like we see vapid speech happening in both realms, and they're always like leaning on each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so surreal. And actually I think there is like magic, like this is the part of the magic of the art world is like, how can you like these people who are literally like inventing and fabricating like cultural relevance and like real-time self-mythologizing, and like it's actually pure fabrication.
Like, oh my god, yes. Wait, did anybody you went to grad school with start talking about themselves in the third person?
God. No, I dropped out 5 weeks right, in. So right, no. Right.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
But that's crazy. That's crazy talk. Yeah. No, so I started getting, you know, like asked to sell art, just, you know, it was part of my hustle. And, at the same time that I was doing Water McBeer and I was running my project space Chapter 61 out of my apartment. And so I was just like doing all this different shit. And the thing is because I was curating shows, people started thinking that I was like this, like trust funder New York party girl, when like the truth was is that I was like a scrappy alcoholic nobody who was like trying to get into like a club that really I had no business being involved in. And I think because of the way I look, people just made a lot of assumptions about me that weren't true.
This is just like the Great Gatsby.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally had that experience. I'm like totally on the other end now. I'm like, ooh, okay, that was weird.
Yeah, like a weird Bret Easton Ellis world or something.
Yeah. Oh my god, I love American Psycho so much. So I did that for a while, and then I heard that Gagosian, the gallery, was hiring in San Francisco, and that's where I'd gotten my undergrad degree. And like, I knew that like I could never get that job in New York, but I know the SF scene so well, and like I knew that everyone in SF would have like a major chip on their shoulder for like the presence of that gallery even coming to their city, because like the art scene in SF is super like old school and has like amazing history, and like just would not be down for it.
Do they have like the sea and air artists or whatever, like those resin artists that just do like those hazy blocks of gradients that are like, there's like a whole California movement of that art.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is like a lot of stuff. There's like Assemblage that came out of San Francisco, and like a lot of those like Barry McGee and like those sort of like street art sign painter artists like all came out of that. I mean, there's like a lot of different contributions that the Bay Area has like made to contemporary art history. But I knew that they were gonna like hate that Gagosian was coming, and I was like, this is my opportunity. Like I wanna work at a blue chip gallery, because I at this point I just had like so much morbid curiosity about the whole thing. And I saw that you could make money like selling paintings, because all it took was like, you've got to like drink the Kool-Aid so hard and genuinely feel like people cannot and should not be living without the thing that you're selling. And you believe that, and you sort of spread that idea around, and people, you know, if you're passionate enough and you believe in it, like other people start listening to what you say and they believe what you say, you know?
It's like Rasputin is my style icon. If I ever end up in the dealing realm, I'm going to do a Rasputin act.
Oh, amazing. I mean, yeah. it's believable, whatever. I sales are sales, you know? So anyway, so I go to fucking SF. I get a job at Gagosian, and I work there for like 6 months. I swear this is all going to end with Jerry. And then I did a Water McBeer project where I curated an Andy Warhol, Richard Pettibone exhibition for Water McBeer. And I had to go down to LA and to put on the show, and like, cause I had to collect these like miniature Andy Warhols from like these collectors. Cause these are like super niche pieces that, you know, there weren't a lot of them made, and I had to like find them, and it was this whole like adventure. And so when I went down to LA, I met up with a friend of mine who was coming back from living this like monastic life in Thailand, and he wanted to study art. And I was like, well, you know, that's going to cost you like $150,000 to study art. And he's like, yeah, but it's like so cool, blah, blah. And I was like, listen, I have a better idea. Why don't you take that $150,000 that you were going to spend on an art education and open an art gallery with me, and I will give you a BFA's worth of education for the price of you backing my art gallery. And he was like,
whoa.
Yeah. And he said yes. So
damn, hot deal.
Yeah. And that was my friend Derek Simons. And so we opened a gallery in Los Angeles. We were open for like 2 years, and it was awesome because I got to like create the art world that I wanted to exist, even if it was just the microcosm of my, you know, the walls of my gallery, and like support the artists I wanted to support. And it was fucking amazing. And then a year and a half ago, I like mid, you know, like not mid career, still early, like under 2 years, but like, you know, doing really well. I got really sick, like terribly, horribly sick. I caught this disease from a tick bite called typhus rickettsia.
And, oh God.
Yeah. And it like made me go blind. It made me go deaf. I lost use of my hands, of my feet. Like, I, you know, was in the ICU. They brought me back to life four times. Man. It was like horrible. It was like fucking crazy. And I...
And how was your insurance during that time? From...
I had Medicaid.
Well, that's good.
Oof. Yeah.
Cause that would be like that would be like $500,000. I was like in the ICU for 12 days, you know?
Yeah.
So I like came out of that. And Derek, my business partner, was like, I'm so sorry, but you are not well, and we have to close the gallery because we can't run the gallery without you, and you are way, way, way too sick. And that was so hard for me to accept. Like, I begged him. Like, I was like, I'm going to be fine. Look, I'm fine. But, like, the truth of the matter was I didn't get out of bed for, like, 45 days after what happened to me. So like I was not okay.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. And you still had to like convince everyone that you could make it because, oh, that's so intense.
Yeah. And like, again, this shame thing that I don't remember if we were recording or not, but like this shame that like I wasn't rich enough to like fund the gallery while I was like laid up in my bed, you know, just like I, you know, and I was just like thinking, oh, everyone's going to judge me and everyone's going to think I'm a failure and a loser. You know, like I was just really freaked out by it. And it was like mainly my ego that was like not wanting to accept the situation.
Well, yeah. And there's like a lot of social pressure involved.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show, it's like, you know, even though you're not a trust fund kid, it's like there are all of these people who have like a lot of independent wealth or whatever, spousal wealth, whatever it is, who are just able to be fine, who can roll with the punches, have emergencies and still be fine. But it's like, you, that's what's tough, you can't compare yourself to them, you know.
Yeah. And I didn't want to I didn't want to like let people down, because like a lot of people were really like, wow, a woman doing this, you're so young, you're 31 and like you're doing all this stuff, blah blah blah. And like, and it's not like, oh, I had a huge ego about it, but I was like, yes, I am doing the, you know, it was like right around the time that fucking You know, Donald Trump got elected and grab her by the pussy and me too, like pitch, you know, like, and I was just like really proud. Like, look, I did this thing and I didn't have to like fuck anyone to get here. You know, like I was feeling.
No, seriously. That was such an intensely like traumatic moment in media. If you, especially just if you are like female identifying and have had any sort of similar experiences to things that were being like aired on a daily basis
every day. I mean, like,
yeah, like intimate crimes are seriously no joke, and the fact that powerful people like abuse intimacy and like people's boundaries and just think, you know, they can get away with it, it's just still infuriating.
The harassment scandal at Artform, I'll never forget it, because it was during right when the Me Too stuff, like the Harvey Weinstein original stuff hit, and it was like coming into the office every day, like we knew that this, that they were protecting this rapist, and we had to do that for like a month every day. It was awful.
Oh yeah, weren't you like hiding the mail or something?
No, the reason we knew
they were hiding it.
Yeah, the higher ups were hiding it, because the reason we knew was because like it was like the receptionist's job to check the mail, so we saw the lawsuit like before they like officially announced it to everybody. But like it was, I'll always remember the Me Too time, because I remember Me Too growing like larger and larger and larger every day, and just coming into the office and looking at like the two, like maybe two coworkers that also knew, and just being like, what are we doing? What can we do? Like, we have no real HR. Like, where can we go? Like, how do we organize? You know?
Get on the internet.
Exactly. Ugh. Yeah. So I was just like loving, having my own art gallery and like curating shows with basically my friends, because let's be real, that's what it is, and like writing about art, and like it was probably one of the like more like blissed out moments of my life. It was very like creatively satisfying, even though artists are a pain in the ass to work with, but like, you know, it's like it's like people when they talk about their kids, because I don't have kids, they're like, oh, they're annoying, but like I love them so much, I can't imagine my life without them. Like, that's how I felt about working with artists.
Like when you're running a space and like you're like giving so much to people, and then like you're like I don't know, it's so much, like you want people to like understand, like I had to like sit people down and be like, we're not getting paid, like the space that we used to run, like we're not getting paid to run this space, like this is all volunteer based. So it's like I get like things aren't perfect, but like we're trying our best here.
Yeah, there seriously needs to be an actual etiquette that people are like informed of when they enter into dealing with making things with others. And I don't know, like it's like, hey, you know what? Here's a little video. It's just like how to use a hammer and a nail, and here's like what I do for you when I hang a show.
It's a lot of work. Here's how hard it is. Boss me around. Like you're not actually paying me. I'm actually volunteering my time to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's the whole thing. That's why I also, again, I go back, like my like judgment, it, as much as I critique the art world, and I like laugh and whatever, it's like, I also know that like more money, more problems, like as galleries grow, as programs become more robust, and as more people get involved, like you think it's hard when it's like an artist run space or a tiny gallery with like a staff of two and then the artist or whatever, like imagine how fucking hard it is when there's like 40 people and 40 egos and 40 like all like different ideas about how things should go, like trying to decide.
I helped out with like the start of an art fair for a few years, which was sort of like that, because some of the people just really thought it was their show, and all of us were, you know, kind of going into places and completely redoing the entire interior. So it's like, if you needed any one of us to remodel your home, we could do it. But we were just there invisibly, like, reconstructing a dilapidated building to have this art fair. and just sort like, and that happened multiple times. So they would do like all these different locations, and it was just crazy to watch like how many people thought that they didn't have to do anything.
My favorite, like, I was talking to a collector friend of mine about like this really rich lady, and I foolishly asked if she had a job. I was like, oh, what does she do? And they started laughing at me, and they're like, oh, Hildy, like, she points for a living. I was like,
oh, wow.
I was like, he's like this really like bitchy gay man, but like when he said that, I was like, oh, that's hilarious.
Yes, shots fired.
I know.
Yeah, but it's like the articles that are coming out about the response to COVID, like on the Upper East Side. There were a whole bunch of people interviewed. I think it was like Bloomberg News or something, or Wall Street Journal, one of those. And it was like, yes, so-and-so has been finding that their daily routine has been completely shaken because they don't have any in-house servants working to clean their linens. So they struggled to find an open service to wash these linens. And then it goes on that the linens are like $4,000 and that they get like a 48-hour quarantine treatment before they get brought back into the house, even though they just got sent out to be cleaned. So they're cleaned and then cleaned again. And then the people interviewed are like, yeah, I really don't know how to do my laundry, so I just send it to them and I figure the cost is fine.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. How to spend your quarantine.
But when did you start the Instagram account then?
Yeah, so I'm getting there. So I got super sick and I had to close my gallery. And I had to, like, move home again and live with my parents in Florida. And I had, like, no friends. And I was, like, just came from, like, living this, like, kind of fantasy life of, like, running and owning my own gallery in L.A., which is a really nice city to live in, and having, like, a nice house and, like, eating well and dressing well and drinking great wine and fucking hot guys and, you know, like, just, like, living a good life. And, like, all of a sudden now I was, like, a 32-year-old, like, who had to stay in bed, you know, 22 hours a day, 7 days a week with no friends and nothing. And
I feel like that's me right now.
The quarantine.
I mean, different reasons.
Yeah. But that's – and memes, like, okay, like, memes, obviously everybody looks at them now. But, like, they weren't, like, the same – like, even, like, 2 years ago, like, memes were just, I feel like memes were more, like, not hipster, because that's, like, a weird word, but, like, they were sort of more niche, and I was, like, following sort of really specific meme accounts that were about, like, I like, Sunny Side Up, and, like, these, like, crazy like teenage boy meme accounts that are like about like, listening to Blink 182 and like cutting yourself at 2 a.m. like,
oh my gosh, like catatonic youths.
Yeah like I would just listen, or it would just like, you know, and send my friend Richie Panic, he's this like DJ, and I would send them like memes at like 4 a.m. that were about like having like sexual problems and always feeling alienated, like, you know, like they were way more like dark and self-deprecating, and that was like my taste in memes back then. And they were not like now, like every single fucking page is a meme page. But I started making memes about like my art world experience, and like some of the earliest memes that I made were like literal like when I first opened my art gallery, I didn't have clients yet for the gallery. So what I decided to do was I went on to WikiLeaks, and you know how like WikiLeaks had hacked the DNC.
Yeah.
I like took all of those email addresses and all of those addresses, and I sent them emails and invitations in the mail and invited them to my art gallery.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So like, you know, I was like scrappy like that, but like it worked. Like my first opening, we had like 700 visitors the first night, you know, like, just, and a lot of these people were like, I have no idea how I found out about you. Like, I remember Eli Brode, like, sent me, like, an email saying, like, I'm so sorry, because he probably didn't realize, he didn't know me. He's like, I'm so sorry, I'm busy that night, I can't make it.
And I'm like, listen, I'm really gonna miss you, buddy.
Yeah, that's wild.
But yeah, I was like, you know, doing stuff like that. So I thought, like, oh, that's like a funny thing to like make a meme about, like, you know, like, so I was just like sort of making jokes about my experience. And like I said in the beginning, like, I remember having like 100 followers, just being like, I don't really get like who these people are that even want to follow this, but like, okay. Yeah, and that was a very long like explanation, but I think it is like necessary, because people are like, how do you make fun of everyone so like well in the art world? And it's like, because I have been every single person. I'm even an art collector now, so like I can actually like make fun of like everyone.
Yeah, but it's great. I mean, just I was mentioning to you the other day when we're just introducing ourselves, that it kind of, your messages really circulate among people and like have a positive effect in terms of like how to morally conduct yourself. Because I've had people talk to me like in a studio visit and just saying like, oh yeah, I love this meme account, it really showed me how to be a better collector.
What?
That's
awesome, but also wow.
Yeah, just like how to be more conscientious. And they figure like, well, if I'm not one of these people that's in these memes, then at least I'm either making a new mistake or I'm being a good person.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's cool. Yeah, I like when people, you know, the other thing is, and you know how everybody in the art world always talks about having like a feeling like a fraud, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think like the thing about Jerry, and this is why I'm sad it's not anonymous anymore, like the fun thing was, is that like so many people started following that, like now I find out are like the director of like Sotheby's in Asia, and like all of the Hauser directors follow it, and all of the Gagosian directors follow it, and like Gagosian artists follow it, and you know, like all these like people that to us are almost like mythological, like unicorns. We're like, are those people real? Aren't they just like people we read about in the news? But I think because everybody has a little bit of this like insecurity, no matter how far they go into the art world, like, because even if you're rich, then you feel like you have to buy your credibility. And if you're not rich and you're just really cool, then you have to like figure out how to like get into the club without money. Mm-hmm. Like it's funny because no one feels like they belong. And I think that's sort of where like money or capital status like has no bearing in Jerry Gagosian's universe.
Oh yeah. But no, it's more kind of like, how are people able to deal with the like the dichotomy of thought if it's like, oh well, you kind of are in this alienated position being anyone in the art world, because it's like a place we don't belong, but then it's also the only place we can go to do our weird sport of art,
because of our, it is such a weird sport, and it's a religion,
and our background, and
yeah,
like it's like we went to art school, we fell for it, whatever. Like, you know, don't go to grad school, we say that on this show too, like don't
fucking drop out, don't even get a BFA, get a library card.
Yeah, go to technical school and learn a bunch of really crafty things that you can use to make art with.
But it's too late for a lot of us, and we're here.
Or go to business school.
Go to business school.
Oh. Or get a law degree, you schmucks. No,
but it's this tough position that we're in right now. I mean, I don't know, I've eked out a spot, like, kind of doing DIY style stuff. I do, like, some meme stuff back in the day. I mean, there was like there's like an era. I think you were kind of saying it, hipster. I think I agree. Sort of hipster, sort of like counterculture type people were doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I was definitely really influenced by like gangster Popeye and Corey in the Abyss and like that sort of like Facebooky, like back in the when everyone was on to Facebook doing the memes, like sort of. Yeah.
And I was just all up with the
jogging. Oh yeah, the jogging. Oh. God, can't forget that.
The jogging for
Brad Trammell. He hates me.
I mean, whatever. That's, yeah, that's cool.
I want to know why, but I can't.
He made like a comic strip about my meme account called Jerry Salty Bay or something. And then like the last line of it was like, to talk, he basically said like, it's embarrassing how unfunny I am.
That wow. Guy is always. Wait,
so says some dude who just like thinks it's really funny to like jump rope for an hour. Like,
seriously.
Like, honestly, I mean, I saw that show. Screw
no,
that
he
shit.
He shouldn't be throwing stones at all. Like, some of his stuff is interesting, but no. Like, he's definitely got some stinkers. Like.
Oh yeah, let's no we're gonna this is like the Tiger King guy.
Yeah, so if he's I'm definitely Carol and he's definitely
oh my god
Johnny Exotic because he's got his little show like bitching about me. No, he actually yes. He's like bitching about Jessica Silverman right now. He's not even bitching about me. This is a long time ago.
Oh my god, that's so funny though. Carol is oh my god, a powerhouse. Like, I can't believe she just goes. She doesn't stop until she's all the way finished. But
I kind of hope she did feed her husband to the tiger, to be honest.
A little bit, yeah.
But it is wild, right? How, going back, I know we're on Tiger King, but how memes have permeated, like, kind of every level of culture. Like, a lot of those folks who are doing, like, Facebook meme accounts now have, like, a show on Adult Swim doing memes. Like,
really?
We got, like, full-on, like, the gallery is memes now happening. This is, like...
Yeah, because it's, like, the cheapest bet for people,
especially
you know?
If the galleries aren't going to be open for quite some time.
Well, not only that, but just, like, taking the way that people think specifically in terms of Adult Swim, it's like, oh, the built-in humor is there, so people are already like aware of your voice and they can be like, hey, you've been funny for this long, write a script, and you've got all these people to bring with you to our platform.
Totally.
Yeah, I've been talking to people actually about doing a TV show, but it's crazy, like you know, the art world or like fashion for some reason, because of like shows like Sex and the City, like people are more willing to go there. But like for some reason, the minute you start talking about, which is fucking untrue because it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, people from all over the world fly to hundreds of fairs a year and do all the, you know, whatever. It's not true that it's not massively culturally relevant. But people are like, oh, the art world's too niche. And I like fight with people about it all the time. I'm like, it's really not though. Like, it's so popular.
Yeah, it's like, less and less niche all the time.
Well,
yeah,
I would say that like all of these different disparate art worlds are all their own niche, and it's just like perception issue. You know, like it's not like that their own niche, but they're their own world, they're their own universe, and it's just like yeah, some people, you know, like there's definitely an accessibility problem with different art worlds, but. Yeah, I don't know. Like I was saying before, like, you know, now that the economy is at a standstill, like, how do we see the future of the art world? Like, are people going to be traveling to all these different fairs in the same way? Like, I wonder what that's going to look like.
Well, I'm interviewing right now on my podcast people, like, from around the art
world.
Oh, good.
Yes, I wanted to mention that you started a podcast.
Yeah, and it's cool because, you know, I talked to Emmanuel Perrotin, who's like a mega gallerist. And he was really, I actually really like talking to him. And I recommend anybody who like, if you like him or you don't like him, I would recommend listening to the podcast because first of all, he was like, I'm taking a big chance talking to you. He's like, I didn't ask any of my like advisors if this was a good idea. I just felt like it was important to do this. So I wanted to do it, which I thought was like pretty cool because he has hundreds of millions of dollars like at stake, you know, and
he's also like a lot cooler than, I mean, he's like more accessible.
Well, the reason he's more accessible, and this is what I learned in the interview, is you know, he was not born into any kind of wealth, and he tried to come up in the art world in the 90s when like contemporary art, if anything, was happening in New York, and back then was, you know, relatively pretty tiny in like the early 90s. So like being French was like profoundly uncool. Yeah. And you just had to be like coming from this amazing family and selling like old masters, you know?
Oh God. Was that like backlash from the pictures generation or something?
I don't know, but yeah, he was just kind of telling me what his experience is like. And he basically said, you know, cause I was like, well, what's going to happen now? I asked the same question that you just asked, like, what's going to happen? And he's like, if I wanted to lie to you right now, I could just try to make you feel better and say like, these art fairs are going to stop and we're going to slow down and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. He's like, but I know who I compete with. He's like, and if I said that that's what we were going to do, they would take that as a sign of weakness and they would just go ahead and push harder and I would get pushed out of the conversation.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, honestly, during the last Great Depression was the time when we saw a lot of like the cities and like aesthetics get established, and now we think of it romantically as like the Art Deco beauty romance of New York, but it's like, no, the whole entire country was in a depression, and then the people who could afford to move forward with building new spaces and like curating art, you know, were working with the Rockefellers and like the Guggenheims of the world. And that just became like the reinstatement of like artistic movements, because it was like so centrally focused. And if anything, I feel like we're gonna see the art world probably like extend to that place where everything is like sort of armory style, or it's gonna be like, I don't know if it's going to be like safe bets on art, but it's definitely going to be like people with tried and true track records are going to keep their careers.
Yeah. Well, the only thing there that is the problem with what you just said is like, there is not one art world. There's so many. And like,
oh, of course.
And like, I'm sure you know that, but I just like, I always have to stress that too, to like people when I talk to them, especially people who are like aspiring either just to be an artist period or to be a professional artist, because like I think that like the disease of FOMO is so awful, and it like really fucks up this idea of local economies. You know, people are always like fetishizing and romanticizing like anything that comes from somewhere else. Like people don't, most of the artists that are in New York are not from New York, you know, like most, but then most of the things that sell in the art world in LA are not LA based artists. They're New York artists who in turn are also from somewhere else. Like, so nobody is like ever wanting to own what is local and what is theirs enough. Like, and I kind of hope that'll change. Like, I talked to Johan Koenig, who owns Koenig Gallery, which is like a gallery in, he has one in Beijing, in Berlin.
Yeah,
one in
Koenig London. And Clinton, right?
No, it's just Koenig, Koenig Gallery. Yeah. And I was talking to him yesterday, and he was like, oh yeah, he's kind of going the opposite direction of Emmanuel Perrotin, and I think you'll see different people taking different positions, where he's like, I don't want to do these expensive art fairs anymore. He's like, because that means that I can only sell a certain kind of art to afford to participate in these fairs. But if I start like looking at what's actually around me and like refocusing myself on like what's local, he's like, I will be able to afford once again to show newer and emerging artists who have like less representation. Because if you're spending $150,000 on a booth for 3 days in Art Basel, plus flights, plus shipping, plus the dinners, plus, you know, hotel, everything, like you easily, you're spending, you know, $215,000 to $250,000 in.
I mean, that's
like
the overhead that makes it
impossible. That sounds so smart to me, especially if you're a mid-level gallery. Like to like if everybody's going to be grounded anyway. Regular flights, like sure, the private jet market is still going to happen. Like you know, the wealthy are global citizens. Like that's already been true for a long time. But these mid-level galleries that are already like not. Like having a hard time like making ends meet with these with all these like fares and other and expenses, like I think to double down and be more local is really smart personally.
Yeah, and also like he was talking about this idea that I think is really beautiful and the sort of thing that I think a lot of people would hope for, which is he was like, I'm remembering what it is I love so much about art, especially now that like we can't participate in these expensive fairs for now and we can't do all these things. Like I have nothing but time. So I'm reading again. I'm looking at artists' works. And he just had like a cornea transplant. He's a blind art dealer. Oh. And he's like, he is. Cool. And he's like, oh, and I can see again for the first time after like a couple years. And he's like, I'm actually like, I have the time now to like sit and look at art and think. And I'm like, he's like, and I feel more in love with it again. And I think that that is amazing. And what a blessing to come out of something as shitty as a global pandemic, that people with power and privilege are having the opportunity to rethink some of these things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's definitely like one of the things that I've been encountering in my community is just, you know, like having some conversations about the way that art comes across and like how best to address the fact that we are not an essential service in the material sense, but that art still serves this kind of social function that we're constantly having to reassess and re-understand the position of. And like, if it is possible to, you know, have a positive effect on whoever is there viewing, you know, and we're not even sure sometimes, like, you know, who's taking in art, who's looking at art, and we see the microcosm of it and we're able to quantify it and, you know, make it a metaphor as it's kind of like stock, you know, we're humans with creative stock. But it's just, it's like in, I don't know, I'm kind of losing the thread because it's sort of like, how can you revitalize something that has been sort of awash with all of this money and all of this cyclical sort of investment? And like, if we are able to do that, like, where do you start? And one of the ways is definitely, I think a lot of people talking transparently now about like what they're losing and what they realized in their solitude. Just like incredibly poetic.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, you know, because I think I saw some memes like on your page that was, you know, two people arguing like, oh, people don't really change. But maybe they do change, but they don't really. But do they?
Yeah, I mean, this is like been my job since all the shit sort of started and I've been trapped inside, is like the whole podcast like project is just literally picking up the phone and talking to people from around the art world, high, low, important, quote unquote, not important, you know, like all different kinds of people. And again, like nobody, there's not one right way to perceive this. Like we all come to this with our own set of like circumstances and the things that are going to change now and the things that are going to be painful for me might not be painful for you. Like, it's nobody's, nobody gets to say like how we have to experience this crisis, but it is interesting that every single person is going through a collective process of rethinking, even if that rethinking doesn't look the same. Like Johan Koenig and his gallery, he's going to do something different. And Emmanuel Periton's telling me like, no, I'm going to have to compete harder now to keep my seat at the table. Like, everyone is going to go through this differently.
Yeah. Depends on what table you're at.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm at the kids' table, so I'm mostly just dealing with the whole thing by eating a lot of weed gummies.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm at the dumbass brats table, just like commentating from the sidelines at this point. But
yeah,
all, you know, I'm just, you know, with our podcast especially, we've just been trying to keep track of, you know, like basically everyone I know has lost their job, and
yeah,
you know, so trying to figure out how to organize all of these folks who, yeah, like what do we do now? A lot of what
we've just been doing, triage, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Triage, and then like, you know, some of the inspiring stuff, like with artists making medical supplies, turning their donating their art supplies to producing medical supplies, like that sort of thing is really inspiring. But then in the meantime, you know, trying to agitate for this rent freeze so that everybody can be all right for the next couple months.
Oh yeah, call your representatives, kids.
It's something we should mention before we stop. Yeah, we gotta.
Yeah, we missed the phone bank. It's okay.
We'll still phone bank even if we miss the official phone bank. I urge everyone to call your reps and
Oh my god, my cat is freaking out.
I heard your cat. It was very cute.
Yeah, she's just
she wants
like
a rent freeze.
Yes.
Have you guys talked to Clinton Lowry?
Who's that?
No.
He runs Art Handler Mag.
Oh, I know the Art Handler Mag folks. We should have
Lucy?
I think there's like two or three people, but I'm friends with Clinton. And he's really cool. He just did like a big like survey.
We definitely retweeted that survey and shared it in our networks for sure. A lot of those stuff.
That's kind of all we've been doing since we entered into this plight was kind of just start like relentlessly tracking all of the different like GoFundMes or different political actions or like ways to organize your building, different like legal information, updates on the governor,
getting benefits, unemployment,
we've just been full on. It's been hard to focus on art actually because things got a little bit too real
labor, a little bit too labor,
a little bit too much labor, not enough art, and now we're swinging back in there.
But yeah, this was really lovely to talk to an artist and talk to someone who knows the ins and outs of the industry. Really appreciate you coming on our show and talking to our audience.
Yeah, I hope it's interesting to them.
Oh yeah, it will be.
Yeah.
I you know, I do want to say like I don't know how you guys feel about this, you know, kind of wrapping this up, but like I think that what is important now, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, is like to continue to work to build the art world that I want to exist. And, you know, this is evidence that what has been attempted in the past, like, it doesn't work. It's a house of cards. Like, one pandemic comes and, you know, 75% of everyone is scratching their head and sitting on their ass. And, like, my mom's friend was doing my tarot. This is actually when I first started Jerry, and I was home sick in bed all the time. And she came over and she was doing my tarot cards. and I pulled this card called the Tower, and it's like this tower that's like got like lightning.
We're very familiar with the tower.
I am. Sometimes I have episodes, or we have episodes where I teach about what tarot cards mean.
We had the tower drawn a couple episodes ago, and I learned all about it.
So I pulled the tower, and I was like, you know, I just had to close my gallery. I just almost died, and I was like,
God,
my life was shitty as fuck. And then she was reading my cards, and I had that card, and she said, you know, you're gonna have an opportunity now to remake your life. She's like, but with the tower, like, if you rebuild the same tower the same way, it's gonna fall again. She was like, so whatever it is you're about to do, try not to repeat yourself, because when the tower falls the second time, it hurts even more. And so, you know, kind of rebuilding and remaking my life, you know, pre-BC, before COVID, like, but building up, it's like I've worked really hard to not like go back to doing the same thing that like didn't work once again. And I encourage everyone to like look around them at like what they have to offer the world and what they can do, and figure out a way to get paid for that and survive so that you can like make art or do whatever, but don't necessarily go back to the same systems like a slave, because you're like addicted to that little bit of money that they're giving you. Like, there is a way to escape that. And I think if enough people were like, you know what, I'm not accepting those like hovering over poverty wages to like do that job with no benefits, with no security. Like, if more people were like, fuck that, I'm not doing that. Or like, if everyone unionized or whatever it is they need.
Now is the time for solidarity. Now is the time.
Like, don't go back to it, because everyone will be right back in the same situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anyone from our audience who isn't like, you know, ready to, yeah, to build those bridges of solidarity. And I think that's a beautiful way to put it, and like really appreciate your experience, like sharing that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, there is some stuff that was starting to happen, like you said, BC, that I really appreciated. Because I don't know, one of the things I was sad about was just kind of finding a lot of programs that were going around traditional models. Like, I was participating in like Shandanken Paint School, mm-hmm. which is a program that's totally free and operates like a grad school, and mm-hmm. you know, it's for painters, and maybe that's like not an interest to everybody, but it meant a lot to me, because I tried to go to grad school the year before and nothing was working out. And you know, it was just sort of seeing the way that like all of our like Yale and Columbia is just falling apart, and mm-hmm. it, you know, it's just kind of like a miserable experience trying, you know, to reckon with the fact that I'm not gonna be a fit for one of those sorts of I don't know, the institutional artist. But like, there was also this fair called Future Fair that was mm-hmm. just happening, which is also a really cool move. All of the profits are shared among the dealers and the artists who present in the fair, like splitsies.
But isn't that how it always is?
No, like if you're in a fair, you like pay the fair for your booth,
uh-huh.
right? And then you are like selling profits, or I mean, you know, you're profiting off of like the artists that you bring to the fair. Uh-huh. But say somebody brings like a $10 million thing, and somebody sells another, like a paperclip next to them, you know, I think what the idea is just like, obviously you're not going to have the disparity in the actual model, but you just kind of share a median, or it's like a tips pool, you know, if anybody has been a bartender.
You're saying everybody in the fair all shares.
Yeah, like if you didn't sell anything, I think you still come out with some
part of the pool or whatever.
Yeah, I believe that was the concept, but they haven't been able to get off the ground yet because of this whole virus. So it was just like, oh, we're trying out this brand new thing. Oh, never mind. Sorry, guys, we can't do it now.
Yeah. And the tons of like union actions and stuff over the past couple of years, and all those workers have, you know, been let go, and maybe they're in a slightly better position because of their union. But all that stuff is, we're going to have to figure out how to keep up that solidarity.
All of our friends at the New Museum Union, at the Guggenheim Union, at the MoMA PS1 and MoMA 53rd Street.
Yeah, think about all these places that were like making, you know, MoMA 3 or like, you know.
Oh,
like,
and Pace Gallery.
Pace, yeah. All
expanding and not unionizing.
And, you know, that has always been more important to them than the people who make the gallery run, their livelihoods. And so we have to find a way to harness all these folks who have been like thrown to the curb and rebuild a new system. I totally agree.
Can we get like some Soviet music behind you? Can we get some little Soviet tunage?
Yeah, let's find some Soviet synth-pop or something.
We must harness the proletariat. Listen here.
I'm trying my best to be accessible.
This is just so, this though, like, we could have a whole other episode on this because I think that like what you're proposing and like to think about the future fair in that model, like, I don't know, like, I don't want to say something wouldn't work because they didn't get a chance to like try, but like that's also just like not how markets work. And
not how capitalist markets work.
So when I say like rebuild, like I'm just like, don't even don't even do the thing at all, period. Like leave the fucking quote unquote art world, like leave it. go create I just had Chris Udemeze on my show yesterday, who was like, who's a Black queer artist, first generation from Jamaica, and he was like, yeah, no, nobody was like trying to let me into the art world. He's like, so I went and I created the art world I wanted to exist, like in nightclubs, in like queer nightclub spaces, and the traditional art world came to me, like I didn't go to it. And I really loved like talking to him about how he's sort of built his career, because he is not dependent on like these shitty structures, because he went off and, you know, we talk about it on the show. We talk about how he has a 9-to-5 job at a corporate magazine, and that's what funds his entire art practice. And I mean, now he just had a show at the New Museum. He just had a show at the Shed. You know, he shows internationally. He does all kinds of great projects. But like, he didn't try to work within the realm of the traditional art world, because he didn't even want to have to try to like pretend to play their game. And now, like, when he wants to dabble, like, he can extend the bridge to like let them come into like his universe.
I just think it's really cool when people form coalitions that have like mutual support built into the structure. And like, if we are going to be continuing on like making objects that are considered aesthetic, or, you know, making experiences that are considered aesthetic yet are not capable of being like, you know, signal boosted through our general media sphere as like a movie, you know, cinema, whatever, there's still some particular realm of thought or action that is labeled art, right? Mm-hmm. So whenever you're doing it, it's sort of like you're a part of the art world whether you want to be or not. And it's sort of like the example like you're saying, you know, if somebody's not like working at a front desk of a gallery, if they are still entering into the sphere where they're a part of the ecosystem, then they haven't left the art world. They're still showing in it, they're still doing it. They're not just like you know,
yeah,
no way, this is just for my friends.
You get absorbed by the spectacle kind of no matter what is.
Yeah, there's like no way out.
But that's, you know.
Yeah.
I think we're all pretty much in agreement here that, you know, we're all just having these conversations now with each other in all these different art worlds. Like, I mean, literally that's what a lot of this show is we have a lot of different conversations with people from all sorts of different art worlds. Mm-hmm. Not just the traditional gallery world at all. We've had a nightclub episode. We've had, you know, different comics people and illustration and design and,
different museum workers too.
Musicians too. And that's, you know, we're all trying to figure it out together because we've all just lost our day jobs and, we're going to have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
we don't know what is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, somebody said to me the best advice I got right before this happened, because I lost my job when I was outed as Jerry and I was like really freaking out. And I'm sober. I'm like in AA, and I went to an AA meeting and I just like was crying, like ugly crying, like totally
like Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Crying.
Like Viola Davis, like bad, you know? And this person like tapped me on the shoulder and was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "No, I'm not okay." And then he was like, "Wait, do I know who you are?" And I was like, "No, everybody knows I'm Jerry." Like I started freaking out. And he took me to dinner, like, you know, because we do that in AA, like we go out for coffee or we go out
fellowshipping.
For dinner. We fellowship. Yeah. And it turned out that he is I can't say who he is, obviously, but he's
yeah, of course.
The director of a mega gallery. And he ended up sharing the story with me where he basically told me that once upon a time, his entire career also fell apart and he went bankrupt and he was like a pariah. Nobody liked him, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, "Listen, the best advice I can give you right now is to buckle up and to accept that this is whatever is about to happen is going to be really hard, and to throw away whatever narrative you previously were attached to of how your life is going to go in the way that you think it should be." And that sounds like really simple advice, but it was so profound. And then COVID hit like 5 fucking days later. So like, I feel like it was the greatest advice ever, because I really listened to what he said and I was like, okay, I am totally going to detach now from this narrative of how I thought I was going to be positioned in the art world, what I am going to do, where my value and service and labor and all this shit, where it actually lies. Like, I'm going to just let go of that and I'm going to just start rebuilding piece by piece, like put my head down. And I didn't know then that that would really apply to the COVID situation. So maybe that message that he kind of gave me will help other people too, is like, sort of, there's a lot of freedom in surrender. There's a lot of freedom in putting your hands up and saying, okay, I'm not doing that anymore. That's over. It's a new world now. Like, it's fucking water world. Like, we're going to rebuild it.
Oh God, I hope it's not water world. Not yet, at least.
We're gonna be rebuilding.
Like, let me get off the island.
It's gonna be better for the workers. That's my prediction, or else it will just collapse again. If it's not. But
okay.
We have gone over.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up. Everybody, please follow Jerry Gagosian on Instagram.
Go-go-zian.
And your new podcast, what was it called again? Art Talk Radio?
It's called AM Art Radio.
AM Art Radio.
And you can just, there's a link in my bio on Instagram if people are interested in following it. It's people from across the art world. So I'm trying to talk to all different kinds of people. I'm going to have Clinton actually from Art Handler Mag on like next week. So you just like, we're talking to everybody. Nobody knows right now.
That's awesome.
Cool.
Yeah,
sounds great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure. I feel like one of those nerds who's been following you for a really long time. So, yeah, this is such a treat.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Great to meet
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Gare.
Nice to meet you too.
If you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy, it doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company. Let's have fun. 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 Lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Lots of fun.